Okay, I think we're going to get started. Welcome back from lunch. I know it was a little shorter perhaps than you like, but we had fascinating panels this morning in addition to Director Rodriguez speaking. We started out really well, so the challenge for my panel will be to continue that, but I know that they're very capable of doing that. And in this panel, we're going to focus in particular with the treatment of unaccompanied minors in the United States, as well as the situation for them in their sending country, both before they leave and if they are returned, what sort of plans exist, at least in one of the major sending countries. I just want to say a couple words before I introduce our panelists, each of whom will talk for about 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up to a full Q&A. And once again, when we get to Q&A, please come down to the microphones and introduce yourselves. We know that the unaccompanied minors from three Central American countries, Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, have been coming to the United States for quite some time, and that in recent years the numbers started to increase, and they increased first gradually and then somewhat significantly, one could say. But this year they were called a crisis. I just want to remind us, in the global context of crises, the arrival of this number of unaccompanied children, whether it was 60,000 people we're talking about, 90,000, or whatever, that is not the definition of a crisis in the global community. A crisis is what is happening in Syria, and a crisis is what happens every time there's huge movements of forced migrants who have to flee for safety reasons. Now, what the children have in common with many of those is that there's no question that the violence in their communities was one of the major factors in their flights. That's not something that's really been debated. Many, we've learned, were also coming to join families. So we're going to have a full discussion, though, of what's happened since they came here. We also learned very recently in these past year or two that more of them were younger and were more female. So larger percentages of younger children and more girls. Ask yourselves why. So to talk about what's going on in the sending country in terms of trying to ensure that kids don't have to flee violence, and in terms of their returns, if and when that takes place, we have Ambassador Altschul, the ambassador of El Salvador to the United States. He's directly to my right. And next to him, to be able to talk about the way that the Justice Department, immigration courts in particular, are handling the increased numbers of children in a variety of ways, we have Barbara Lean, who is the counsel to the director of the Executive Office from Immigration Review, directly to the ambassador's right. And to Barbara's right, we have Maria Wolchin, who is not only a professor at the University of Chicago, where she teaches a variety of courses on immigration-related issues, but she is the director of the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, who has been working to develop a significant core of child advocates. So for lawyers in the room, here's a different role that lawyers can play in the process when children arrive from abroad in a country. So I've asked Maria to talk about what her organization, the Young Center, does, how the most recent increases in numbers have affected the organization, and particularly about the concept of best interests of the child and how that is being deployed and some of the challenges with that. So we're going to begin with Ambassador Altschul. You'll see that some of our panels will sit, some of them will stand. I've invited them to do whatever is most comfortable. So we'll begin with you, Ambassador. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First of all, let me thank the organizers of this event for giving me the opportunity of sharing this panel with such distinguished persons and with you all. As it was said by Andrew, migration is not new, and even the migration of unaccompanied children is not necessarily new. In just in the case of El Salvador, in 2009, there's records of 1,200 unaccompanied children coming here to the United States. In fiscal year 2012, this increased to 3,300. And fiscal year 2004, which is referred to as the crisis, we had 16,000 unaccompanied kids. So it is new, but it has increased, and has increased considerably. So one question is why? I'm sure you all know, the issue of migration, there's not one single cause. There are multiple causes or push factors that have to do with migration. And all of them exist right now, in the case of El Salvador, in the case of the Northern Triangle countries. It is always mentioned that economic reasons are a fundamental cause, and it is true. I mean, people migrate because they cannot find the opportunities in their in our own countries to satisfy their most basic human needs, the lack of jobs, lack of opportunities, health opportunities, education opportunities, and so forth. So that's always been a push factor and a cause for migration. But things haven't gotten worse in El Salvador, so that is not in itself an explanation of why the surge in unaccompanied children. The same could be said about the security issues. It is true. I mean, we are all living in a very violent situation. The crime rate, et cetera, the gang violence, and so forth, clearly are push factors. Right now, Honduras is considered to be the most violent country in the world, and in San Pedro Sula is considered the most violent capital in the world. This is a questionable membership that San Salvador and El Salvador had 3 years ago. So this is going on. It's true. It are push factors. But in the case of El Salvador, at least, things haven't gotten worse. They even have improved. So therefore, that by itself doesn't explain either this surge. Another important factor was mentioned already is the family reunification. Again, talking about El Salvador, we have thousands of Salvadorians, just the TPS beneficiaries, over 200,000 Salvadorians who have been living here, working here for at least 12 years, probably more. They left the country, they probably left their young children there. They haven't seen them in 10, 12 years. So now they have the means, they have the stability. They say, this is the moment for me, and I can pay for somebody to bring my kids back. So that is also a factor in all this. But again, that itself does not explain the situation. What is it that has changed in my perception which explains this? And it's basically, I think, an issue of the smugglers, the coyotes, that the coyotes had discovered that if they send a message that if the kids came to the States and they came in, they were not going to be deported. We know that they were telling people, you know, they will be the green card, they might be given a citizenship. And so this is something that it was a marketing strategy. A very successful marketing strategy. And I think that explains why. Because what we are seeing, I had the opportunity to visit the border 3 or 4 weeks ago. We were in a detention center in Carnes, and the opportunity to talk with a lot of mothers there and the kids. And we asked, how long has the trip take? And they say, well, 10 days, 12 days, 15 days. When we know that traditionally this journey took 2 months, 3 months. And how did you travel? Well, we took a bus. So clearly this is not the normal process of immigration that we have been used to for all this time. This is a new way. And actually, it is referred to as the VIP treatment or the express treatment. And we know that people pay between $8,000, $10,000, or even $12,000 to bring one person in. So this has become a big, big business. And I think this is what explains, without taking any relevance or importance to the other push factors, but this is why I think explains the surge. Now, I think it's important to also see that in these three issues, the economic situation of we are facing, the security situation we are facing, and the issue of family reunification, it is true that those are more the responsibility of our countries, but it is also a shared responsibility with the United States. Because if we are now seeing the effects of economic policies that have been coming for many, many years that created the marginalized population and excluded the great numbers of our people, this was in part also the responsibility of the U.S. policy at those times, supporting many military dictatorships in Central America and authoritarian regimes, and supporting basically the ruling elites that created this economic situation. In the case of the security, there is also some sort of shared responsibility, because the majority of the violence that we are receiving, that we're having in our countries, has to do with drug trafficking. And we are, unfortunately, in a very important geographical situation, because the drugs are produced in the south, they're consumed in the north, and they have to come through our countries. So it's basically by geographical reasons that we are suffering a lot of this. And in terms of the family reunifications, I would say as well there is some shared responsibility, because many of the policies, migration policies that you very well know, have prevented of and at least has not facilitated this family reunification processes. So I say this not because I want to blame anybody, but to say the solution to the problems are still a matter of mutual cooperation and shared responsibility. And what is the solution? There are short-term responses, of course, to this crisis. We have reinforced our consular offices in the border states. We have opened a new consulate general in McAllen, Texas. We have increased our cooperation with ICE and with the U.S. authorities. We have improved our reception capacities, the capabilities in El Salvador. We are organizing networks of support at the local level throughout our consulates to provide support for the kids that are going to eventually stay here or while they are still here, in legal assistance, in education, in medical health, mental health is very important, and so forth. But we are very clear that the solution is medium to long term, and that the solution has to be in providing economic development and better conditions of life for the people. That is our responsibility, our main responsibility, but again, it's an opportunity for joint and shared cooperation. At this moment, you might remember that a couple of weeks ago, the three Central American presidents from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras were here in Washington, had a meeting with President Obama to analyze the situation of the kids. And one of the things that came out there was that our three countries would prepare, with the help of the IDB, the Inter-American Development Bank, a plan to address the situation. This plan is already in the works. It's still a roadmap, but I think it has very important innovations. One, it is prepared by the countries. It is not as other plans, economic development plans, that were basically elaborated here or through in the multilateral institutions. This is something that has been the work of our three governments working together, which is very important. It's not very easy that three countries come together and come with a plan. Second, the idea is not to do a big development plan, but to focus on the specific territories which produce the largest number of migrants. so as to implement concrete projects in those territories to provide better security, better job opportunities, better education, better health care, in order to create the conditions that would, if not prevent, at least mitigate the migration. That is what we know very well, that that is, or we believe that that is the way to go. We can do short-term solutions, but unless we address the root cause of migration, which is providing better conditions, security, economic, and opportunities of life, we will not be able to stop that phenomenon. So I would like to leave it here and gladly answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. I'll ask each of our panelists to speak first, and then we'll be opening it up to questions. So, Barbara.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here this afternoon. As many of you know, what EOR do, we're the Immigration Court System and the Board of Immigration Appeals. After the kids came through this summer, there was a lot of focus on their immediate care, immediate feeding, and shelter. Our agency focused a little bit more on what the long-term way to process these children are, because after they go through the border and they go through where they're going to be temporarily and they're reunified, they come to us for their legal proceedings. And so the children are typically with us for quite a bit of time with respect to their legal proceedings and how they are processed through the system. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the changes that happened at our agency with respect to processing some of the kids, and then I'll speak a little bit to representation and then a bit about some of our next steps. So many of you know one of the things that we did in response to the influx this summer was that we added additional priority groups to our pre-existing priority for detained cases. So what that meant was that we were prioritizing the cases of recent border crossers, which was loosely defined sort of as people who came on or after May 1st. DHS identifies who those people are, and typically it's four different categories. It's unaccompanied children, adults with children who are detained, adults with children released into the Alternatives to Detention program, and all other detained aliens. And so those are, I'll sort of use, they're sort of the recent border crosser priority caseload. I'm going to focus today on the kids because that's the topic of this discussion. So we started processing priority cases July 18th. And so what that means is that when we get a priority case as identified by DHS as an unaccompanied child, that child receives their first master calendar hearing no less than 10 days and no more than 21 days from the DHS's filing of the NTA with the Immigration Court. So that goal is just for their first hearing. So we just need to make sure that they get in and start their case within that 21-day period. So, one thing that's on everyone's mind, and we get asked a lot of questions about, is representation and access to legal services for the children. We work really closely with other government agencies as well as nonprofit organizations to explore ways in which we, as the court system, can assist in trying to help these kids get access to legal services. This summer, we issued some guidance with respect to how to utilize Friend of the Court services. In the past, we've issued guidance to immigration judges on how to employ child-friendly court practices, and sort of reiterated that with our judges as we knew that they were going to see a lot more cases. And what the procedures that they can take in order to improve pro bono participation in the court system. We created specialized children's dockets in all courts that see children so that we can ensure that children are not coming to court at the same time as adults. And so those child-friendly procedures can be implemented in that special time when the kids are there. In addition, we expanded immigration judge training, and we expanded the legal orientation program for the custodians of unaccompanied alien children. So it's important to note that that program is something that EOR runs. The Office of Refugee Resettlement does run Know Your Rights presentations for the children, but our program focuses on their custodians. So when the kids are with their custodians, we provide services to the custodians to let the custodians know what's going on. Let them understand what's happening to the child. Help them understand what, you know, their responsibilities are with respect to making sure the child comes to court, making sure they know what resources are available to them for legal access. The other thing that we did this summer, because that program, the LOPC program is what we call it, doesn't operate everywhere. We expanded a national call center that allows custodians that are in areas where this program, the in-person program, is not currently operational, to be able to call in to a center and ask questions, try and understand what's going on with the kids, you know, get an understanding of what, you know, what they have to do, what the kids have to do when they get to court, and to help them understand what resources might be available in their communities to help them. In addition, some of you probably saw, we announced this summer a partnership with the Corporation for National Community Service. A lot of you know that as the AmeriCorps or VISTA program, where EOR put about $2 million of its funds to start what's called the Justice AmeriCorps program, where we'll be funding about 100 attorneys and paralegals to provide direct representation to qualifying children. These are typically children that are under, that are 15 years of age and under, who are going to immigration court. So we expect that to be operating in about 15 cities. And, you know, it's basically what you can imagine. You know, we're utilizing the AmeriCorps program to get lawyers into the courtrooms with the kids. And so it's a new partnership, and it's really exciting. We expect the attorneys and the paralegals to be on the ground in the court in about January, the beginning of the year. So I think for us, you know, we're anxiously anticipating that program getting on the ground and operating in a lot of our courts. We're happy, you know, we work very closely with the Office of Refugee Resettlement because they also fund some programs to provide legal services to the children. And so we work in tandem to make sure that we're trying to get adequate coverage in the country. And also to set up programs that will allow us to study what the impact of direct legal representation is for the kids. We understand that it's important that when we have government programs to look at them, see what they do, both sort of on a more anecdotal level in terms of, you know, social science gathering with respect to, you know, conversations about how the kids feel when they go through, but then also just the hard statistics about what impact this could have on the court system. So we're working on that with the Justice AmeriCorps program. We also launched a small representation pilot in Baltimore, where we're going to have some direct legal services there as well. And so in addition to that, we are undergoing a lot of outreach. I see a couple of faces in the room that I know I've met with a few times this summer and probably will continue to meet with this year. Right now, our director and deputy director are in Texas. They're going to the cities, the six cities that have the most unaccompanied alien children in them, in order to meet with legal service providers and adjudicators and people on the ground in these cities to see what it is that the agency can do to help process these kids through the immigration court in a way that, you know, assists the legal services groups in the area in being able to have access to provide the kids greater levels of legal services. And so we're really trying to go out, understand what's happening on the ground in the courts, and work with the communities in order to make sure that we are working together to try and make sure that these kids get through the legal process the first time in a way that makes everybody very comfortable. In addition, we're also having model hearing programs to try and train the nonprofit attorneys. I think a lot of you in here are immigration attorneys, so you know what you're doing when you get to court, but sometimes you get a real estate attorney in there who's doing a good pro bono effort, but you want to make sure they're well-trained before they get in there. And so we're working, all our judges are volunteering their time to go in and try and teach some of those real estate attorneys how immigration court goes. So those are a few things that we're doing to try and work together with groups, you know, with the national groups, with the local groups, to try and increase the access to legal services. A lot of people are asking us, well, great, you know, you have this priority caseload, we get it. Well, what about everyone else? What about my asylum client who I've been working with for several years? And, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but as those cases of those kids and some of the recent border crossers and our detained caseload are priorities, there are other cases that simply are not. And so what ends up happening is that some of the cases for non-detained individuals who are not considered priority caseload do get bumped back, and they get bumped out further. You know, you don't have to tell me that those cases are waiting a long time in our court system. We know. And so you were evaluating options for what to do with some of those cases that are either going off the calendars or going way far out into the future for their individual hearings. We've made our resource needs very clear. I think the administration has done a very good job in making our resource needs very clear. We're continuing a hiring effort. You know, we should get about 25 new judges on this year. We're looking, we recently advertised 48 immigration judge positions in anticipation of a budget that I hope someday will come from Congress that will tell us exactly what we can do and how many judges we can hire. But, you know, hearing time is our most precious asset a lot of times in the immigration court, and we simply need more judges, and we need more court staff to support those judges. And so we are trying to hire what we can, and we're making our case, and the administration is making its case to Congress with respect to the resources that we need to handle the full caseload that we have that's increasing. And the other thing we're looking at is we're trying to find ways sort of on the margins to increase some of the efficiencies in immigration court. You know, seeing what we can do about trying to encourage pre-hearing conferences, you know, doing proffers, that sort of thing, just in the normal course of what you might expect in a court proceeding that aren't typically institutionalized practices in immigration court, to see how we can more, you know, to utilize some of those resources and institutionalize some of those practices in a way that allows us to, you know, efficiently process those cases while making sure everybody is heard. And I look forward to taking any of your questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Barbara.
Okay, I'm gonna stand up.
Excellent, Maria.
Well, I just wanna start by thanking Andy and Don and MPI for inviting me here today. It's really great to get to talk to all of you and see so many faces that I know. I have to say, after this morning's panel, the last panel, a lot of this is just going to seem pie in the sky, or at least it did to me after the last panel, because we're advocating that there be a best interest standard for unaccompanied children and that all decisions be made in accordance with the child's best interests. But I also think that we need to keep our eye on what may happen next, and also going back to this morning's panel, if they're right, and they all seem to agree, if the Democrats lose the Senate, if the House moves farther to the right, we may all start seeing children being deported in significant numbers. So I want to start with really what's going to be my last point, which is that in all of our other systems in the U.S., when we move a child, there's a process. We have what's called an interstate compact. So in all 50 states, if we're going to move a child from Illinois to California, California is involved, Illinois is involved, and there's an assessment of whether that child will be safe if he's moved. Child Protective Services, if a child is removed from the home because of abuse, five relatives come forward to take care of that child. They're all vetted, criminal background check, child abuse check, lots of checks before we move that child. And it's the same with ORR. ORR doesn't release a child without going through a process of looking at that sponsor. But in our current system, we have nothing in place for ensuring that child will be safe, and we have really no system in place for even making a minimum inquiry about that. So I want to add a little bit to what Andy said at the beginning about what's happening right now. The number of children arriving at the border has decreased, and ORR beds are at about 65% capacity. The numbers today are, each day, approximately 55 children are arriving at the border. In June, it was 300 children a day, so it's a significant drop. The causes are uncertain. We don't yet know. We don't yet know if it's going to be as a result of the hot weather at the end of the summer, or if there are other reasons, for example, bolstered borders by Guatemala, Mexico deporting many more children, beefing up enforcement. What we do know is that children are being deported from the Mexico border, the Mexico-Guatemala border, and the violence has not abated in the three Central American countries. So 68,000 children arrived last year, and they are here. And as Barbara pointed out, the initial impact was on Office of Refugee Resettlement, but and they modified their systems for releasing children. But now this is all going to hit the immigration courts and all of the other systems. It's really going to start impacting how these agencies work. Okay, so just a little bit more. Andy said I would tell you what we do. So we're based at the University of Chicago, and we serve as child advocate for unaccompanied children. And this is very similar in child protection systems to a best interest guardian ad litem. So our job is advocating for the best interests of unaccompanied children. And I will also tell you we have no best interest statute in our immigration law. But having said that, that's our job, and so we advocate for their best interests, even in the absence of the law. Child Advocate was provided for in the TVPRA of 2008. It provides that HHS has the authority to appoint independent child advocates, and in a slightly backwards way, says the role is to advocate for the best interests of the child. I think one of the things that's really important about that law is it requires the child advocates be independent. We are not the attorneys who represent the children, even though some of us are attorneys who work on these cases. We don't work for the attorneys representing the children. We also don't work for any agencies that provide any other services, home studies, post-release services, or care and custody. And why is this important? Because oftentimes we have to advocate with all of these different services providers, and sometimes even with attorneys. We do see situations in which kids are represented by attorneys who are hired by traffickers in the case of Chinese kids. So we get involved in those cases. And sometimes we're arguing that a child has a case when she may have been screened initially, and we may have a lot more information. So we're going back and advocating on behalf of that child. We don't get assigned to all of the children, only the most vulnerable of the vulnerable, so tender age kids where there's a custody issue, a child who has a mental health issue, a child who has been abused, a girl who's pregnant as a result of rape, a child who's recognized by everybody in the system as being at risk if he's returned, but he won't give enough information, he won't talk about what happened to him, and yet everybody in the shelter, the lawyers, lots of people think this kid is going to be at risk if he is sent back to his home country. So what's been the impact of the influx on our organization? Well, first of all, we're just unbelievably busy. We have an office in Harlingen, Texas, where most of the kids are coming in. Those cases are the most difficult and complicated. Very young children, situations of abuse, situations where we don't know who the parents are. And then we have an office in Chicago. And I think the influx has affected a lot of what the government is doing right now. So although there was a provision in the law providing for expansion of child advocate programs, it hasn't happened until now. So the government, ORR, has asked us to open offices in three new locations, Houston, New York, and Washington, D.C. So that's just one of the side things that have happened as a result of the influx. So our philosophy, though, is that best interests should be driven by children's rights. And so what this means is that what the child wants is very, very important. And in most cases, we will not go against that unless the child's safety is at issue. We can't just say that Honduras is dangerous and he shouldn't go back. We have to have very fact-specific information about that child. We have to be subject to cross-examination by the child's attorney, by the judge, by the trial attorney. We have to prove what we're saying. Okay. Best interests, I just want to talk a little bit about that. First of all, it's the law of all 50 states. It's also the law, obviously, of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and the CRC, that language in the CRC came from our laws, and yet when it comes to immigrant children, there is no best interest standard. So what does best interest mean? Well, there's really not a precise definition. It really varies case by case depending on the child's situation. But in state court, it means that a judge, when they're placing a child or making a decision about that child, has to consider, is the child going to be safe? Is the child going to be separated from family against the child's will or against the parent's will? And is this what the child wants? So this is really, this is also really important for immigrant children, and that we need to have a system in place where we make an assessment of whether a child will be safe, whatever the decision is, whether the child is going to stay or is going to return, that the child should be able to express their own opinion, and that we will only oppose that child's expressed in wishes if he or she is going to be in danger. So we don't have federal law to look to, so we have to look to international law, Convention on the Rights of the Child, we look at comparative law, cases from other countries, and then we look at the law of the state where the child is in custody, and we analyze the child's case according to those factors. And then we take that information, put it into a report, and then put it in the hands of the decision maker, be it the immigration judge, the ICE officer, whoever, ORR, whoever is making a decision about that child. So I said earlier we don't have best interest standard, but I also would like to say that there has been progress. So over the last year, agencies have been involved in getting together as a group with NGOs to develop a best interest framework for unaccompanied children. And they're doing this in the absence of an actual statute. This is being done through the Interagency Working Group on Unaccompanied Children. It's a project funded by the MacArthur Foundation. And the idea is to come out with a framework so that people in these agencies can take the child's best interests into consideration when making decisions. It is not going to be required. Nobody is going to sign this document, certainly, but it will, when it's finished, be a document that everyone participated in drafting. And I just want to be clear about best interest. This does not mean that the decision maker, the immigration judge or ICE, has to make a decision that is in the child's best interest. That judge can also consider safety to the community, national security. There may be a myriad of other factors that that judge can consider, but what it means is that judge has to look at what's in that child's best interest, that child's safety, and that it should be a very important factor, especially if we're going to be removing a child, separating them from family, from all they know. It should be a factor. So, okay, back to what's happening right now. As Barbara said, EOIR is prioritizing cases involving children. They're getting speedier times when they have to appear in court. Some judges are still granting lengthy continuances, but some judges are granting much shorter continuances. And as you all know, kids have to find their own attorneys. I also think it's fantastic that all of the government agencies, EOIR and ORR, are working to provide attorneys for kids. And I think that's also another side benefit to the influx, is that agencies are much more concerned with having attorneys for the kids. I also think, and this is just my own personal belief, that neither judges nor immigration officers like having to make a decision about a child in front of them without an attorney representing them. And so I think that there's an impetus in the agencies, too, to have representation for kids. The other fantastic thing that's happened is that there are now dockets for released children. So it used to be, for example, in Chicago, a child who was released in or around Chicago came to court any given day of the week, any given time, to any different judge. And so there was absolutely no way for anybody to serve these kids, no way for a lawyer to be present and represent all the kids. And that's changed. EOIR is now having all of its courts set up dockets for released children. I think this is really important and a big step towards getting representation for these kids. So here's the other reality about right now. We're really not deporting kids right now. The kids who came in recently during this recent influx, they are not being removed. But, and this goes back to that earlier panel today, which was pretty much doom and gloom, if things change, we may start seeing lots of kids deported in very significant numbers. So I think we're really faced with two problems when it comes to kids. Has that child been able to access protection? And that just goes back to, did they get a lawyer? And then even if they have a lawyer, are they going to qualify for any kind of any of the forms of relief that are available? Because our system, for the most part, was built for adults. I also think that there's a misconception among some, although probably nobody in this room, but among others, that if the child is determined not to be eligible for any form of relief, he'll be safe if he goes back. And I think that's really untrue. First of all, many kids still don't have attorneys. I think it is nigh impossible for a child to get immigration relief without an attorney. Nobody's going to disagree with that. I think pro bono programs are fantastic and really critical, but there needs to be money for the agencies that have to mentor those attorneys. As Barbara said, that real estate attorney really doesn't know what he's doing when he goes into immigration court without an organization backing him up. I think asylum is very difficult to establish. It's difficult for an adult. It's difficult for a child. That on account of language and the five factors, these kids have to make that same case, and it's really difficult. We do have special immigrant juvenile visas for kids who've been abused, abandoned, and neglected. It's wonderful. It's a good law. I think countries in Europe are very envious that we have this law. Very imperfect. In Chicago, in Cook County, children cannot get into our juvenile court if they are detained, for the most part. In lots of parts of the country, it's impossible to get into juvenile court for a variety of reasons. And so we really do need a best interest standard, because a lot of these kids, even if they go through the system, even if they get a lawyer sometime, there may not be any form of relief available to them. So I just want to talk a little bit too about the gap cases, and that's what I mean by kids who don't qualify. And that was a term coined by Andy. What it means is the child's case doesn't fit neatly within a form of protection, but it's not in the child's best interest, safety, or well-being for him to return. So a couple of examples. Child's parents are in the United States. 12-year-old boy in home country, let's say Honduras, is living with grandparents. One of the grandparents dies. The grandmother gets really ill and can no longer take care of the child. So she sends the child to the United States. His parents are here. His parents are undocumented. So what's in this child's best interest? He wants to do the right thing. He wants to go to court. He wants to do all that's expected of him, but he's not going to qualify for these forms of relief. And yes, there is prosecutorial discretion, and in some places that is available. The trial attorney will exercise discretion, but that child still has no avenue for permanency, and really it's another person added to the 11 million in this country. It's also very difficult in some jurisdictions to get prosecutorial discretion. Another example, a girl from Fujian province in China, she comes, everybody knows she's got all these kids come, they get smuggled over here, the parents typically make the arrangement, and the kid has an $80,000 debt. She's still in custody, she hasn't begun working, and so she's destined for trafficking, but the trafficking hasn't yet happened, and the second problem is, how does she prove coercion? It was her parents who sent her. Now, I would argue that you do what your parents say, in not my kids, but lots of other people's.
Not a lot of kids.
But she's got that's a burden of proof for her in establishing a trafficking for labor case. So then there are the cases that I think are really complicated for judges, where the child, and we've seen this a lot, and we call it detention fatigue. A child has been in custody for a very long period of time, and they've given up. It's a child who's probably eligible for some form of relief. You know, my example is a kid who says, two of my friends were killed. I know I'll be killed if I go back, and I want to go home. So we recently had a case involving a 17-year-old boy from Central America. He fled. His mother was a drug trafficker. He was deeply distressed by that and wanted to get away from her. His dad died when he was very young, and he was being threatened by the gangs. So not an uncommon situation. In the U.S., he was hoping to reunify with a man. He was an American tourist he'd met, and it was determined that this guy had, he was a registered sex offender. So there was an investigation. Office of Refugee Resettlement obviously determined this boy cannot be released to this man, but the boy had no other sponsors in the United States. He's been detained for 5 months, and he just can't take it anymore. And I want to say, you know, shelter, people who work there are absolutely wonderful. The kids are cared for very well, but you're locked up. You cannot leave many places. You have to be escorted from one room to another. It's really tough on kids to be in custody. So, but the child tells his attorney, I want to go. I want you to ask for voluntary departure, and if you can't get that, I want removal. So this child has a child advocate, and the child advocate goes to the judge and tells the judge all the reasons this child won't be safe. He's got nobody to go back to. He's been threatened by the gangs. He has said, and even said in the court, that he wants a quick death. It's better for him than sitting in custody. So what should happen? The judge listens in this case but doesn't know what to do because there's no guidance on a case like this. What our judge in Chicago does is punt. She will continue the case for a month, and she'll tell the child, I'm going to continue, and ask the child, is that okay? And most kids are going to say, yes, judge, that's fine. And then she'll admonish everybody to work really hard to get this child out of this restrictive placement. And in most cases, the child will change his or her mind, not in every case, but in many cases. But that doesn't solve the larger issue, which is that this judge is being called on to make a decision about a child when knowing or having factual information that this child might not be safe if that order of removal is issued. So I think we need a plan, a process. I also think, you know, we're all in this together. This is a regional problem. We have to work with El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, to figure out what's going to happen next if kids are going to be deported. As you heard this morning, families are being deported. It's not yet happening to children, but we don't know what's going to happen in the next few months. We certainly thought it was going to happen at the beginning of the summer, and from what we've been told, nothing is really taken off the table at this point. So it could still happen. And so one of the questions is, what are the sending countries doing? Are they going to be capable of receiving thousands of kids back in their countries? So I just want to go back to my original point, which was, in our country, in every system, we have a system in place. Before we send a child, we check to make sure they're going to be safe. We check to make sure there aren't red flags. At the very least, there are no red flags to say this child is going to be in danger if he goes back. And really, at essence, when it comes to determining best interests, that's what it is about. It's about safety. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Maria. So why is immigration law different from every other aspect of American law? We'll pick that up after you have a chance to start asking questions. So for those who would like to pose any questions to our panelists, please come forward to the mics. And I'll ask that you identify yourself, and if you're directing your question to any particular panelist, to let that panelist know who you're directing your questions to. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Diane Eikenberry, and I'm a senior attorney with the Capital Area Immigrants Rights Coalition. I work with the detained children in OR custody in Virginia and Maryland. And my question, well, I sort of have two questions, but they're related to training and stakeholder relations. And sort of two parts for Barbara and for Maria. First, Maria, I just want to thank you so much for the wonderful work that the Young Center does.
Thanks.
I've had the pleasure of working with one of your child advocates out of the office in Harlingen, and you guys just make a great difference, and I just am so excited that you're opening new offices.
Thank you.
We need more of your work.
Thanks.
But Barbara, you mentioned that there's expanded training for the immigration judges. Can you speak a little bit about that, and also maybe generally about what kind of training, if any, is required for immigration judges around issues related to these unaccompanied minors?
So we have done some training with the immigration judges. You know, some of you know, because of budgetary issues, we've had to have our conferences on DVD for our judges. We had planned a conference actually this summer, a live in-person conference that we had to postpone in part because of the surge, and we didn't want to take all the judges off the dockets for a week. But we are planning on having, you know, a conference at some point where we expect to have a full day of a kids track for kids, for the judges that handle kids cases. And, you know, like, Maria's a frequent appearer at all of those. You know, we really do try and bring in the outside experts, bring in the people who do do some of the work more directly with the kids, the stuff that comes before they get to see the judge. And so, you know, and we listen, you know, we'll reach out to some of the judges and say, like, what are you interested in knowing more about? You know, I think we look at what's happening sort of this summer and, you know, have looked at, well, what are things that might be more important? You know, should we have a particular panel on, you know, asylum claims that are really specific to these types of kids? And so, you know, we anticipate having a full day just for kids. And I expect, what I understand from the judges I've talked to, is that I expect it's going to be really popular, given the fact that we have so many judges now hearing the kids' cases. And then when we have our training, we record it all, so that, like, if there's a judge who really wants to go to another panel at that time, they can request to see it at another time, like on DVD. So, you know, we understand that training is important. So we are expanding it with respect to dealing with the kids and how to make sure that procedures are appropriate for the kids and to the specialized needs of what the kids both need in a courtroom and there are types of relief that are just for them, right? Like special immigrant juvenile status, you know, that's just for them. So to talk about what some of those things are as well.
Professor, may I ask a
question? Sure, go ahead.
Maria? Thank you. Maria, just speaking of stakeholder relations, you mentioned the best interest document that's being worked on by the interagency working group. Is that the main way in which the Young Center has had sort of relations with DHS? Do you guys have any other sort of stakeholder relationship, especially with the Office of Chief Counsel? And do you anticipate that this is a document, once completed, that could be, you know, we could be providing or sort of collaborating with the trial attorneys?
Yeah, I mean, we work with all of the agencies, and I just have to say that, I mean, DHS has been one of the really good agencies to work with. I mean, the irony has been that enforcement people have been wonderful. And again, I go back to this point that I think those charged with enforcement and decision-making have a really hard time having to do this with a child. In terms of the document, you know, we hope to finish it in the next couple of months. It has to go to the full interagency. It's been a subcommittee. It has to go to the full interagency working group, and that's all of the agencies plus NGOs, most of whom are in this room today. And yes, that will be shared, and it'll be in two pieces. One will have footnotes, and the other piece, though, will be kind of a step-by-step, here's what you would do if you're in the field to make sure you're looking at a child's best interests. So yes, that's the intention, is to share it widely. Yes.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for those questions, Diane. We'll go from side to side. So on this side, please identify yourself.
My name is Constance Freeman, and I work with the Community Outreach Program. I work with a lot of the children after the ORR process, so I see them months, sometimes years, after they've been released from the shelters. And I'm concerned, one, about how many of the 14 to 15-year-olds specifically that are not enrolled in school. And I want to know, how can we get that collaboration with the agencies to make sure that they are staying in school? Because I don't have a problem with accepting children and making sure they're in school. But if they're 14 years old and they're out of the day labor line, I'm not sure that we're not putting them at risk that they're running away from. And then also, I have a follow-up question for the ambassador from El Salvador. I was amazed at how many children in those three countries are not in school. And I noticed in one of the South American countries, kids get like 80 bolivianos or something to go to school, and if they get good grades, they get 100 bolivianos. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if those three countries could use funds from the multinational companies to fund so that the kids are in school and they're not coming here without a day of education.
So, I mean, I'll take the first question. I think there aren't enough resources anywhere. None of the agencies, well, EOIR doesn't have enough, ORR doesn't have enough. I will also say that recently I've heard that ORR is doing a lot to start providing more post-release services for children. And I think they've recently issued grants to start providing, so after the child is released, there's somebody who is available to stay in contact, a social worker, for example, and to help make sure the kids go to school. So again, though, I mean, I think this, some of it goes back to resources, and of course, everybody wants the kids in school, but I think we need more resources so that there can be more post-release services for the kids. And I agree that after the kids get released, I mean, sometimes they're even more vulnerable than when they're in custody. And a child advocate stays with the child to the extent that the child wants. I mean, kids can lose us if they really want to. But I think this, you know, we need these post-release services for many more kids.
Ambassador?
Yes. You are right. I mean, one of the, unfortunately, we have, compared to many other countries, a fairly low level of school attendance and a large level of school desertion. Now, a couple of things. The new government has established three priorities, one of them being education. So education is going to be a priority in this administration. Second, there is a program, new but starting now, of conditional cash transfer precisely around those lines to give some economic support to families that keep their kids in school, similar to something that's happening already in terms of health. There's a cash condition program to support economically mothers who take regularly their kids to the health clinics for control and so forth. And the third thing is that, ironically, one of the reasons that we have had a lot of youth involvement in the gangs is that at some point during the 80s, in order to make more efficient the school infrastructure, schools started working on two shifts. So kids would go in the morning, a group of kids would go be in school in the morning, and another group of kids would go in the afternoon. What happened is that you have a lot of kids having a lot of free time. And this was something that created, among other things, many other things. But this also was a part of why a lot of kids joined the gangs. So one of the things that are being done now is to expand the program called full-time schooling, in which the idea is to keep the kids as much time as possible in the school doing extracurricular activities.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Ana Sol Gutierrez. I'm a state legislator here in Maryland and originally from El Salvador. Many questions, but I want to concentrate on something that we have been advocating for both locally. We formed a D.C., Maryland, and Virginia coalition to work with the students, and I think many of us in the audience probably are dealing more with what to do with those students once they come to our neighborhoods and are in our states, because it doesn't end with the federal role. But the federal role is important. One of the issues that we did was bring up service providers from around the nation to see the legal representation issue. And I'm surprised that you haven't mentioned or anybody has mentioned the disparities in the way that the legal, the courts are working. We raised it, and what we saw was that some states, like Maryland, has a very friendly, it has the first hearing according to your 21-day guideline, and then maybe the second one with sufficient time to prepare to get legal representation. There are other states, New York and California, where the service providers are just in desperation because of the rocket dockets. Could you address what are the possibilities of your organization, Barbara, to provide something more than just a 21-day guidance? Because the response we heard was that a lot of the immigration courts are being left to the discretion of the state and of that court. And therefore, you're seeing this in unequal application and practices from one state to the other. And I think that's a very serious concern.
So I just want to clarify that your question is about the immigration court system and not the juvenile court system in the state.
No, not the juvenile court.
Okay.
No, the
okay.
ones who are dealing with the children, the ones that have that first hearing.
Right. Well, I mean, the two are bizarrely interconnected, I think, as Maria mentioned.
Juvenile courts are state courts.
Correct. Although if children are seeking, so one of the challenges.
They're not being called to a juvenile court. They're being called to.
Well, some of them are. So with respect to one thing that's really interesting about this group of cases for our system, which can be very frustrating at times, is that some of the relief that is available to these children and the relief that they seek is adjudicated outside of our court system. And so one of the forms of relief that they seek is special immigrant juvenile status. So when a judge is trying to figure out, you know, how much time he should give a child that's looking to seek special immigrant juvenile status, they have to figure, okay, well, USCIS is going to have to adjudicate a benefits application, but before the kid can go forward, they have to go to state court juvenile proceedings. And so that does provide a real logistical challenge for us, because there are states in which, you know, and counties in which, you know, as Maria mentioned, a child can go to state court proceedings and get a dependency order in 3 days. There are other places, Chicago being one of them, where it takes just a really long time. And so when a judge is trying to figure out when to reschedule the kid, those things can come in. Now, with respect to what our guidance has been to judges for immigration court, the guidance that we give immigration judges is nationwide, right? So it's not, we have one immigration court that has 59 locations is sort of what we like to say, as far as what, you know, there is uniformity in the guidance that we give judges. It doesn't vary by being in one state or another. The guidance that we've given is that the children that are identified by DHS as priority cases get their first hearing within 21 days. Thereafter, the judge can continue the case, if the child asks for continuance, can continue the case in accordance with the law that's on the books right now. It's a good cause standard, and then the judge determines in his or her discretion how long that continuance should be. And so it will vary with respect to the facts and circumstances of the particular case.
What we've heard is that as routine in these two states, they are being called for their second appearance very shortly after the first appearance, without any possibility of legal representation to be, one, identified, and two, to be prepared, and that is really even interfering, because they then have to go in and file another motion. I'm not a lawyer, but this is what I've heard over and over again is what's been happening. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that because you are one centralized system with 59 representatives, that clarification of what would be expected, and even if there is no best interest of the child in written law, clearly in every state, I can tell you in my state, that is the guiding principle. And if that is not what is in practice being respected, I think there's something wrong.
Right. So we did issue guidance on September 10th that specifies that there are no extra laws relating to how short continuances need to be or how long they need to be with respect to children, only just that they do take a priority on the docket, so that the continuance should be granted with respect to the facts and circumstances of the case rather than the court's docket So, you know, we heard this concern, and we did issue guidance on September 10th. Yeah.
Yes, go right ahead. Thanks.
My name is Ashima Dugal. I'm an immigration attorney turned documentary filmmaker. We're working on a film specifically about this issue, Central American refugees filming in Central America, but also some of the issues that we're seeing in the U.S. My question is more for Barbara as well. I wanted you to address some of the concerns identified by attorneys who have been volunteering at Artesia facility. I know that's, you know, a family detention center, but nevertheless, some of the concerns, that's putting it lightly, just some of the fast-track deportations, the no access to sometimes translators, interpreters, long-distance judges who, you know, aren't very well-versed in the law or the cases. I know things are improving, but from, you know, some of the reports I read and talked to, it's nowhere near where it should be.
Do you have a specific concern in mind that you want me to address?
I haven't read anything, because I have been researching this particular topic. I haven't read anything that the government has put forth to talk about Artesia. But I've read a lot from attorneys.
Right. So I think with, you know, with respect to family detention, I guess it's somewhat germane, given that, you know, there are children there too, though they are not unaccompanied. With respect to the detention of families, you know, the Artesia facility was put up quickly in response to the surge this summer. I think what's frustrating for, I think, us as an agency is that so much of the detention center and the concerns with respect to the detention center are out of our hands with respect to decision making. ICE handles detention. So when there are larger issues that I think people have brought to our attention, you know, so for example, people have said, look, the TVs there are really tiny. And so when the judge is beaming in, you know, what you see on the side of the detainee is, or, you know, the individual, the families who are there, they're having a hard time seeing the judge. So when we hear that kind of stuff, and people are very vocal with us to let us know what the issues are, you know, we can't buy new TVs and install them, right? Like that, the DHS does that; it's their facility. But what we can do is go to DHS and say, "Look, we'd really like you to change these TVs out." And so, I think what we're doing is on a very daily basis, having a lot of conversations with our counterparts at DHS about how to respond to some of the things that we can respond to. I think a lot of the criticism that we've heard overall from some of the advocates is that there is, you know, a generalized belief that families shouldn't be detained, right? And so to the extent that that is what we're hearing, you know, I can tell you that is, you know, that's a decision that's made sort of out of my hands, certainly out of my logistical hands. One of the things we also heard was, look, you've got judges in one time zone, you've got Artesia in another time zone, that's causing just confusion. So we changed from the judges in Arlington hearing the cases to the judges in Denver hearing the cases, because now they're all in the same time zone. We're also working a lot, I think, with the bar in Denver. Even before the cases got moved to Denver, we're really active in trying to do pro bono with the folks in Artesia. And so, you know, Denver was a good spot because we thought we could assist in trying to make it a little easier on some of the pro bono attorneys there. So I think we're doing what we can, you know, recognizing that, you know, we have to continue a dialogue with people about what are the things we can do, particularly some of the smaller, you know, what are some of those small things that seem, well, why can't you just do it? Like, why can't you just buy the bigger TVs kind of thing, right? And working with our partners, I mean, understanding, of course, that there are a lot of limitations on us as the agency dealing with the detention center that we don't have control over.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Hi there. My name is Dina Dolgarian. I'm a student here at Georgetown Law, and I'm here with some fellow classmates of mine. We are part of a campus organization that has created the International Migrants Bill of Rights, and our specific project this semester is focused on detention centers in Mexico. And we are creating a list of indicators to suggest that these detention centers go through. My personal indicator is focused on family unification. So I was wondering if anyone on the panel is able to offer myself and my classmates some advice and realities on what is going on in these detention centers, specifically with unaccompanied minors, whether their family or guardians are in Mexico, are in their country of origin, or are in the United States.
Excellent start to conducting research on that issue.
It's
so, does anybody want to tell Dina what we know about that situation? The extent we know anything.
I don't know much at all.
And why don't we know much, Maria?
Because we need students to do some research and tell us what's going
on.
We're
all looking forward to reading your results.
And you need to travel there and talk to people and really, yeah, what do you do? And figure out what's
going on.
Georgetown
funds our travels, that'll be great.
I'm focused on New Mexico right now, so.
So perhaps, though, the ambassador, you talked about consulate, I guess, both having a consulate and border states. I assumed you were talking about U.S. border states. But after all, Mexican southern border plays a huge role here, maybe the borders of other states on the way up for the children particularly play roles here. Do we know anything about that?
Well, what we have done is we are mostly working with Guatemala in establishing a joint consulates in Mexico, particularly in the road or the path of the migrants. So the idea is that if Guatemala has a consulate in this town and we don't have one, that we can share those facilities and vice versa. We have increased our conversations with the Mexican government also to try to provide a little bit more protection to the migrants. I don't have any specifics on how this is going. What I can tell you is that there is an excellent network of shelters and of efforts provided by civil society who are doing an incredible job in assisting the migrants, providing them with shelter, with food, etc. There's a serious network of this type of support going on in Mexico. I think more than no, I'll leave it like that.
Okay, thank you.
And have you had good cooperation with the Mexican government over these issues?
In some cases, yes. There have been, as you are very well aware, very horrendous incidents that have happened. You know, a group of 60, 70 migrants have been killed in just one. And in those cases, there have been sometimes mixed results because it is presumed that there is involvement at certain levels of some authorities. The drug dealers are a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
Big problem. It is very clear that the drug trafficking network is now together with the smuggling, and as I mentioned before, it's become even in some cases they say a better business to do human trafficking and smuggling than drug trafficking.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Ashley.
Ashley Venetti. I'm with the Georgetown Institute for Women, Peace, and Security. The panel mentioned that we're seeing a particularly large increase in the number of girls that are crossing the border. And I was wondering if you could address why that is, what particular gender-based vulnerabilities we're seeing at play, and then, as a two-part question, how the system is treating that, in particular in trainings at EOR, when you're working with these young girls.
Talk about the training. You can talk.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing more girls. I mean, I think it's because of the safety issues in these countries. And, you know, if you're a parent here, and I also want to add, I mean, 55% of the kids are being, are coming and reunifying with parents, which goes back to the whole issue around no CIR.
But if you're a parent here and you're worried about your daughter, you're gonna bring her. And I think that we work with a number of girls who are victimized by the gangs, and you know, rape is one of the things that they use against the girls. So. So I think that's the primary reason why we're seeing more girls, and we have, I don't know if this has slowed down at all, but we have seen many more younger kids under the age of 13. And again, I think this is for the same reason. You have either parents in home country who are worried about their kids and want them to be safe, or, you know, you've got family here that want their children to be safe.
I think with respect to certain, with the sensitivities to young girls in particular, so it's important to note that while there are increases in the number of young girls and increases in the number of tender age children, it's still, you know, we're still seeing is like older boys.
But didn't the age drop to 13, 14 compared to 16, 17? At least that's what the government reported back in late June. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I think we're seeing more in this group, but I think overall, right, if you're looking at how many kids are currently processing through the immigration court system, you know, we're still very heavy on older boys. So, but that's to be, you know, but as we're responding to this group that's coming in and we're seeing mm-hmm. them now, right. You know, we've always known, and there's always been a group of vulnerable young girls in our courts. And so when we've had trainings on child sensitive issues, we've looked into, you know, talking to the judges about some of the issues that might be not exclusive to young girls, but more prone in terms of prostitution and the trafficking, and you know, rape on the way here, and how to handle that kind of thing, you know, and judges will, and I think, you know, Maria gave some example of this, to say, you know, look, it looks like something's going on here, you're not ready to talk about what's happened to you, and then they look, you know, this goes back to, you know, a judge being able to look at the individual facts and circumstances of the case and say, okay, this looks like a case where I might have to give, you know, this kid a continuance for a lot longer, and talk to legal service provider that might be there and say, look, is this something that you can, you know, try and get this kid some help so that they can better articulate what's going on. But again, this all, you know, may go towards looking at some of the, you know, gender-based asylum claims, looking at TNU visa issues and that kind of thing. You know, with respect to the funding that we had for legal services and the Justice AmeriCorps program, we focused, the program will serve children who are 15 and under. And in part, that's a response to the increased tender age kids that we were seeing, because, I mean, the funding will only go so far, we will only be able to serve so many kids. And so, you know, knowing that those kids are probably, you know, a little bit more vulnerable or less able to articulate themselves, that's where we concentrated our funding.
Thanks, Barbara. Marie, you want to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing. I mean, I think it's not only the judges, but I think there can be training for lawyers and anybody who works with kids. I mean, we have done this, ask the judge to close the courtroom, because it's somebody, either a girl who's got to testify about very specific and traumatizing information, or a boy, or, I mean, you can do that. And I think, though, there needs to be more training for anybody who's representing kids. And the other thing I'll say, and it's something that I wish we could import from the child protection system, in child welfare we have what are called child advocacy centers, and they're in most jurisdictions. If a child has been abused in some way, the child goes to the child advocacy center. Everybody sits in a room behind, they call it mirrored glass, and there's somebody who knows how to interview a child, and they interview the child. The police are behind the glass, the person representing the child, so that the child only has to be interviewed once, and then that report is made available. And it's something that I wish that we, and it would probably mean we need to get ICE to work with these child advocacy centers around the country to start doing that, because it's so much better for kids. They have to tell their stories over and over and over, and it's really difficult.
Thanks, Maria. We're running out of time, but since two of the three questioners who remain are for my former students, we'll allow each of them to pose a question. But do me a favor, Michael, just start with a question. I'll have each of you just pose your question, and then we'll have the group answer them as a whole, if that's okay with everybody. At least everybody gets their questions in. So we'll start with Michael and then...
Thanks. I'll try to be fast. Michael Cooper at the Plowshare Group. I'm a member of the New York City Bar Association's Immigration Nationality Committee and the chair of the subcommittee on the right to due process and right to counsel. And so I'd like to ask a question about the right to counsel. So we've framed that issue in terms of what we call three factors, the three C's: complexity, capacity, and consequences. Immigration law is extremely complex, maybe second only to tax law here in the United States. Children simply don't have the capacity to represent themselves, even though our immigration courts sort of presume that they do. And I need not say anything about the grave consequences, but the way we framed it is that when you bring these three factors together, the confluence of those three really is a perfect storm of due process violation. Mm-hmm. So my main question to you is, it's great that we see resources being poured into this from cities, from states, and from the federal government, and that we're sort of rallying the pro bono crowd to the cause. But from my perspective, that's really a needs-based approach rather than a rights-based approach. So I'm wondering what more we can do to sort of vindicate what we perceive to be, you know, an absolute right to counsel.
Thank you, Michael. Sir?
My name is Jonathan Ryan. I'm an immigration attorney and the executive director of RAICES. We provide legal services to the unaccompanied children who are detained in San Antonio, and we spent the greater part of our summer working with the children at Lackland Air Force Base. Between June 9 and July 28th, we met with over 2,100 children, and we provided them individual legal consultations and determined that over 63% of them have strong cases for asylum or other forms of humanitarian relief. That's a number that is ratified by the UNHCR findings and by the fact that we are presently starting to receive positive adjudications in those cases. I'm struck by the comments of the ambassador regarding the motivations for these children to come. They reflect what I've heard from other government officials over the summer, that yes, these are the most dangerous countries in the world, and yes, their lives are in danger, but really they're just coming here because of the rumors spread by smugglers. To me, that's like saying that people jump out of burning buildings because they think that the firemen are down there to catch them. These are refugees, and I think that to say that they're only coming because of those smugglers' rumors is a facile excuse for the violence that's occurring in those countries. I'd like to know from the ambassador what measures is the government taking currently to ensure the safe repatriation of children who are returned to your country, and whether you're taking any measures currently to prevent children who are fleeing this persecution from exiting your country. Mm-hmm. I'd also like to know from the immigration court if you could maybe unpack some of the reasons and motivations for the new prioritizations. I've been practicing in immigration courts for over 10 years, and what I'm seeing currently right now is a whole lot of nothing going on. The judges do not make many adjudications in the cases of unaccompanied children. They're kind of a ringmaster. So I'm going to court often, and I'm seeing the judge talking to little children, saying, "That's a nice pink shirt that you have. How are you doing?" And then resetting the cases. There aren't a lot of decisions being made right now in the San Antonio Immigration Court that I can see. Meanwhile, we have hundreds of clients who have active 42A, long-term permanent residents who are now waiting even longer to get their cases decided. Other asylum seekers who need to get out and work, these are children, they can wait. Meanwhile, the important cases seem to be pushed back. So I'd like to know what was the reason for that.
Thanks for bringing that out. But not least.
Daniel Costa from the Economic Policy Institute. Not a lot has been said today about root causes, and rightly so, it's not the topic of the panel, but for my question, I think it needs to be said that a lot of why kids are showing up vulnerable and terrorized and victimized is because it's a direct result of U.S. policies in the region. The Northern Triangle countries are essentially economic client states of the United States. We've been intervening financially and militarily for the last 100 years, even intervening in coups directly. And so my question is, it doesn't seem like anything is going to change in regards to those policies anytime soon. So while the numbers of kids may go up and down, it doesn't seem like in the medium or long term this is going to change. So are federal agencies, providers, aid providers, people who are representing kids in court, are they thinking strategically for the long term and how to deal with these kids? How do we protect them and take care of them, you know, 10, 20, 30 years from now, because it's hard to believe that the flow is going to end.
Thank you, Daniel. So I think the best way to proceed, given that we now have basically run out of time, is just ask each of our panelists to say a few words. I would encourage you to address any of the particular
particulars of the questions towards you, for example, safe repatriation, Ambassador. Why don't we start with you, and then we'll just go down the
road. Okay. First, if I didn't, I thought I said that I still believe that the traditional causes of migration, violence, economic, look for economic opportunities, and family reunification were still valid and were all reasons for migration. What I said is that that didn't explain the specific surge that we have seen in the past 2 years. That is where I think the roles of the smugglers comes. And this is not to, to diminish the importance of the other causes, which are of course the more structural causes of the problem. What are we doing in our country to, try to prevent this? We are doing campaigns, media campaigns, to to educate the people about the risks and about the fallacy that if they come here, they are going to receive green cards and citizenships. So those perhaps do not explain by itself the decrease that we've been looking at in the numbers of kids coming. There are weather reasons and cyclical reasons that have been mentioned, but I do believe that these campaigns which are being are going on in the three countries have are starting to have an impact. We are also working in pursuing and strengthening the border, the control of our borders, and going after the trafficking networks. In terms of, as I mentioned also, these are not short-term measures. The solution is not short-term. These are medium to long-term solutions. In the issue of security, for example, which is a very complex one, we've started now by doing certain concrete things like implementing full-fledged the community policing. This is an idea in which the police, instead of just being a force that will react to a 9/11 call or whatever, the denuncia, the idea is that they are members of the community, the police stay there, they are actors, local actors, and become local actors, and this has by far been proving one of the best policies to confront violence and provide better citizen security. As I said, the long-term solution is economic development. This is something that cannot be done from one day to the other one. But that is where we are all aiming in the medium and short term, to invest in the territories that are the ones that produce the more number of migrants.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Barbara.
So to the first issue about the right versus needs-based approach to counsel, we're being sued by lots of folks, so I can't really speak to that one. Got a couple of my lawyers in the back over there. So we'll leave that to the advocates to talk about.
Lawyers don't let you talk, huh?
Yeah, no. A couple of DOJ attorneys in here, sweat beads on their faces. So the next one with respect to the rationale, right? So the rationale for setting sort of that 21-day goal for the first master calendar, you know, it was our agency's response to the president's directive to process the kids. And I think with respect to, you know, there are cases, you know, if you look at, you know, our adjudication timelines and how long it takes for a case to get through the immigration court, you know, there were courts where if you filed a notice to appear on a kid, they weren't going to get their first hearing for over a year. And so the idea here is that you get the kids started in the process. And so if what happens is that the judge says, look, do you want an attorney? Here's a list. You know, if you want to start trying to find an attorney, here's what you need to do. Or, you know, here are the types of relief that could be available to you. Talk to me about what your circumstance is. And essentially to start at the beginning of the process, start early in what's your story, what's going on with you, to try and figure it out a year earlier than maybe it would have happened 3 years ago. And so I don't think there is an expectation that the child's case is going to be over, certainly in 21 days, or, you know, like I said before, there's a lot of aspects of relief for these kids that are completely out of the hands of our immigration judges. The USCIS does the asylum cases first. The visas are handled by USCIS. A lot of the SIJ is handled by USCIS and some of the state courts.
And so to the extent that there's a sense that judges are a ringleader, I think that's not a great term, but I would say, you know, they do sort of oversee a lot of things going on with these kids. And they aren't necessarily, you know, in charge of the forms of relief that may be available to them. But I think there is a benefit to starting the process and saying to the kids, let's figure out what's going on with you. But this is one of the reasons that our judges have discretion to continue cases, to, you know, allow the appropriate time for the adjudication of the case. And I trust our judges. I think they know what they're doing. And they know how to assess the facts and circumstances of cases in order to make sure that a child's due process rights are protected.
Thank you, Barbara. Maria?
Okay, well, I'll go back to the question about the right to counsel. I mean, obviously, I don't think anybody in this room would not agree that children need counsel and that there should be a right to counsel. I don't think you'll find anybody here. Well, I don't think so. Not Barbara. I wasn't looking at you for a reason. I think we need a change in the law. I think there are some in the government that think that we can't provide counsel for everyone. I think it's a beginning that EOIR, ORR are providing, paying for attorneys to provide direct representation. It's a beginning. It's not everything. We did get a provision. There was a provision in the Senate bill last year that would have provided counsel for all children. So it's a start. I think we're all going to have to start over on that. And then I guess in terms of root causes, I don't think on my side of the table we're doing enough. I think it's something we all have to talk about because I think it is a regional program, regional issue. I think we need to work with El Salvador when we have a child who's at risk of going back to El Salvador or has no choice but to go back to El Salvador and work with people in the government there to find a way to get that child back safely or to connect him or her with somebody to receive him. And I think Obama wanted more money to deal with root causes, but of course he didn't get that, and it's probably, you know, it's a lot of money. So I think we just need a lot more resources for everyone, for the countries in the region, for the agencies doing this work, and we need a right to counsel, and we need a best interest standard.
Thanks, Maria. I want to thank all of you for your questions. I want to thank our panelists for a very rich discussion. Please join me in giving them a round of applause.